Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, finally some better news about our energy bills. The price gap is dropping from July, so does that mean a return of competition to the market? Inflation is down. That's good news, right? Mortgage rates are rising, though. Act now if your fix is coming to an end, warns experts. Also today, could we be on the verge of a financial Armageddon across the world? Simon explains what exactly the US debt ceiling is and why it matters. Plus, camper vanflation. It's a thing? Well, it is now. And it's rampant. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, we had some better news this week about our energy bills. The price cap is coming down, saving us around 400 quid a year on a typical bill. The last 18 months have been, let's be honest, pretty horrendous for households. So bad, the government had to step in October and introduce a price freeze. But that was still double what the typical bill payer would have had to fork out a year previous. So what will we have to pay in July? When will prices return to pre-COVID levels? And does that mean a return of competitive fixed deals to the market? Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Helen. Firstly, Helen, a brief recap, if you would. Just remind us, what is the price cap? What is the energy price guarantee?
Sure. So the price cap is the maximum amount that people can pay for energy per kilowatt hour. That's set by the regulator Ofgem. This price cap didn't really used to matter much to most people because most people were on cheaper fixed deals, which undercut that price cap. But it's become a lot more important in the last year or so since prices started going up. And that was due to the rising cost of wholesale energy impacted by things like the war in Ukraine. In October 2022, the price cap had been going up for a while because of these rising costs, and it was going to go up at that point to more than £4,000. So the government stepped in and they introduced the energy price guarantee. So that was set at a lower level of £2,500. It's important to say that these figures are based on the average household. So if you use more, you will pay more. But that £2,500 figure was set for the typical home. So that was essentially the government subsidising bills below the level of the price cap, essentially, so people could still afford them. That's been paying since October, but as of this week, the Ofgem price gap has come into play again. So that's gone down to below the level of the government's energy price guarantee. So we're back in the world of the price cap, and that has been set now from 1st of July to £2,074 a year.
Which sounds a lot better, doesn't it, than 2,500? Sounds a lot better than over 4,000, that's for sure. Why has it come down? Why have they reevaluated this? Because I thought, you know, if we were to have the price cap in place now, because they've still been announcing it, even though it hasn't been in play because of the government energy price freeze, we would be, what, three and a half grand over the winter? It would have been over £4,000. So the government's price freeze is essentially saving, even though it's taxpayer funded, saving us some money on this one. Why has it come down? We still have a war, sadly, ongoing. Are we all more resilient? Have we all built energy power stations that will shield us from Russian? I mean, what? Why?
Because what's happened is we saw a spike, and the spike was driven by a sudden event, an unpredictable event. Some would argue not entirely unpredictable. Vladimir Putin had eyes on parts of Ukraine and his grimy fingers over some of it for quite some time. But it meant that when the invasion happened, you know, and bearing in mind at that point, there was, you know, the week running up to it, there was a lot of like, there's not going to be an invasion. And all of a sudden there was an invasion. It suddenly rocked the markets. That also came at a time when the world was coming back from COVID. Demand had been ramped up substantially for energy from consumers, from industry, from all around the world. And it caused a price shock. And a price shock sends, you know, prices soaring up into the sky. What exacerbates that as well is trading. So there is a big, big energy trading market. You've got people trading, you know, futures and energy contracts and things like that. And herd mentality within trading and investment markets provides what is known as momentum. And momentum is a fairly powerful force in trading and investing. And when basically something has the wind in its sails, it can quite often keep going and keep going and keep going. And prices overshoot. They always overshoot. The problem in this instance is prices overshot and then stayed there for quite some time. And then there was the question of, well, hang on a minute. What do we do now? So prices came down slightly. Then there was the right, Europe needs to rebuild its energy storage supplies in order to get ready for the winter. So last summer, we saw a price spike as Europe was desperately trying to fill up all of its gas storage as much as possible in order to tide itself through the winter, to wean itself off the reliance on Russian gas. So we don't import a lot of Russian gas in this country, for example. We're not reliant on Russian gas. So why the hell were we paying more? Well, because the global gas markets don't operate in isolation. It's like, well, you guys are paying this much because you're buying the Russian stuff, and you guys are paying this much because you're not buying the Russian stuff. The price of all gas went up. And so that triggered this kind of prolonged shock. Now, what was successful was actually, A, they managed to fill the gas storage quite successfully and more than people thought they were going to manage to. And B, we then had a mild winter. Part of winter was actually pretty cold, even across Europe as well. But that was the later part of winter. The early part of winter and autumn as well was very, very mild, unseasonably mild. Anybody who remembers the pictures of the ski resorts after Christmas, where it was green fields rather than snowy mountains, will understand how mild the start of winter was. And actually, that was a much better scenario than having a cold start of winter and a mild end of winter. That would have caused gas prices to be still much, much higher and would mean that we were probably still relying on the energy price guarantee. But the way it worked is that has basically taken a lot of the heat out of the gas market, the hot air out of the gas market, the gas out of the gas market. I don't know, what do you want to say? But basically it's brought it down. And now we've got the scenario where in wholesale markets, prices have fallen enough that the energy price cap can come down. Now, the interesting thing about the energy price cap, of course, is that actually, had it just been totally reliant on spot prices, i.e. the price of buying gas tomorrow or electricity tomorrow, it would have come down much earlier than now. But it's not. It's done on the kind of futures and contracts, and you know, all of the energy companies that buy their energy like for delivery tomorrow, they all went bust quite some time ago when the energy market completely collapsed. And so it's the more sensible ones who are left, which means it's taken some time to filter through. The bad news is, though, is it's not a scenario where it's gone from, you know, the energy price guarantee 2,500 level to 2,000 now, and then in 3 months' time it's going to be 1,500, and then in 3 months after that it's going to be 1,000. We're staying at high levels for some time, if you believe the analysts.
Why are the analysts suggesting that this is going to stay at that level for some time? Because as much as this is, you know, it, on the face of it looks, yeah, great, that's a big drop. It's still really high compared to what we're used to paying.
Oh yeah, it's really high compared to what we used to be paying. It's like, it's one of those weird things where you're celebrating the fact that your bills are massively higher than they were because they're slightly lower than previously. Because we've still got the Russia problem. You know, that hasn't gone away. We've just managed to mitigate it to a certain extent. So until that problem is solved, will that problem ever be solved? And actually, also, you have this deglobalization thing. You know, you have the reshoring going on and everything else like that. There's a lot of factors coming into play post-COVID as well that mean that it's a very different energy market to the nice, calm, serene energy market of years gone by, when everyone thought it was totally okay to be very reliant on Vladimir Putin for their energy and nothing could ever go wrong.
Indeed. Of course, when we talk about the price cap, we're talking about a cap, Helen, on the standard variable tariff, the default, essentially, tariff, because in normal times, you could get a fairly decent fixed deal, and it was always the default tariff that was the more expensive one. We saw fixed deals completely disappear, little bit come back of late. Will we see some competition finally? So actually, we may be paying less than 2,000 odd quid a year for a typical bill, not for everyone, obviously.
Yeah, so there hasn't been any fixes for a long time, as you said. There's starting to be kind of whispers now that they might come back, but they haven't really yet. So one of the only ones we've seen a little bit earlier this year, OVO launched a fixed rate deal at £2,275 a year. It was just for its existing customers. And actually now with the price cap going down, that deal doesn't look so good anymore. Experts are kind of starting to say that there's no reason now why suppliers couldn't start to explore bringing back fixed tariffs, but it hasn't really happened yet. But I think in the next few weeks, possibly, it could happen. But you do need to be careful because you obviously don't want to jump onto a fix now and then the price cap could change again in 3 months' time and you could be paying over the odds. So I think look carefully when they do come back at the pricing and kind of make a call on where you think the price cap is going to go. That's obviously really difficult to do, but I think fixing too close to the price cap might not necessarily be a great idea. It's one of those things where it's going to have to be a call that you make, but you know, it will be good to have the competition when it comes.
Yeah,
I think it'll be one of those things where once one company does it, they'll all kind of flood in, but not just yet.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, do you want to be the first wave which comes, because they're sort of testing the waters, aren't they, the companies with the prices, and then others might come in. So we shall wait and see on that one. Just finally, Helen, on this one, any tips for those struggling to pay? Any advice for those struggling to pay?
Yeah, so do talk to your supplier and sort of sooner rather than later. Energy firms, they do have funds set aside specifically for helping people who are struggling, and they do have obligations to help people. For example, they could put you on a payment plan. They, in some circumstances, because it can even reduce the amount you owe. So definitely worth calling them. You know, they've got systems in place to deal with that. In certain areas, you could also talk to your council. Some councils have funds to help people with their energy bills, you know, courses and advice to see if there's any local grants going on. But definitely, as with all sort of potential debt, you know, don't ignore the situation, tackle it and, you know, see if you can get any help.
Good advice as always, Helen. Thank you very much. Some other news we got this week, which on the face of it looks good, right? It's not an insignificant drop we got in the latest inflation figures, 10.1% to 8.7% for April. But experts are pricing in another interest rate rise. So this all sounds a bit odd, doesn't it, Simon Lambert? You know, interest rates down, tick. Well done to the government, because that's obviously their policy to get it down. It's all thanks to Rishi. Interest rates, though, to continue to go up. What's going on here?
Yeah, I know. It's good news, isn't it? Inflation's out of double digits. We can all have a little party and celebrate. As I wrote in my column this week, it's a sign of the times that inflation coming out of double digits is seen as something that we should be celebrating. You don't need to have a particularly long memory to recall the Bank of England desperately trying to get inflation up to its 2% target, not down from 10%, you know, five times that target. But we are where we are. The bad news is, of course, is it still means that stuff is going up at a rate of 8.7% a year. It's not getting cheaper. I mean, some things are getting cheaper, but most stuff isn't. Food is definitely not getting cheaper. The problem is that there was a nasty lurking in here. The silver lining was around a very, very dark cloud. And the dark cloud was something called core inflation. One of those economic sort of things that you would argue, like, maybe just people should never really need to know about. You know? Like, people could just get through their whole lives without really knowing about core inflation. But core inflation is basically the inflation underlying the inflation. It's consumer prices inflation with energy, food, alcohol, and tobacco stripped out. Why'd you do that? Well, thinking is that energy and food prices are volatile. And they're subject to large spikes up and down, so they can skew the number substantially. Alcohol and tobacco, on the other hand, are largely, the price of that is largely at the mercy of tax. So you strip those things out and you get a truer picture of what inflation is.
Yeah.
A truer picture that obviously excludes some fairly essential life I'd items think. Such as gas, electricity, petrol, and food. But you get the underlying picture. Now, the problem with core inflation is it jumped from 6.2% in March to 6.8% in April. That's a worry. Monthly figures are volatile, and you shouldn't rely on them too much. But the worry is that actually, if you look at the underlying core inflation picture, not just at the month, it's not peaked. So whereas inflation has gone up and it's peaked and it started to come down, and I'm tracing a line in the air here that nobody can see apart from you and Helen.
He is doing that, by the way. Yeah.
Core inflation hasn't. It's continued to tick up. And this is a worry in people's minds for the Bank of England. Therefore, the market goes, the Bank of England is going to worry about this. Interest rates are definitely going up one more time next time, and they're probably going to go up another couple of times after that, because the bank needs to be seen to be tough on inflation. It's desperate to be seen to be tough on inflation because it keeps getting a kicking for letting the inflation cat well and truly out of the bag, and trying to blame everybody else, and point out that it's not its fault, and then it gets another kicking for that. So it needs to be seen to be tough. The MPC's rate setters are probably going to keep voting for interest rate hikes. Maybe 4.75% isn't the peak now. Maybe 5% isn't the peak now. Markets are now thinking 5.5% might be the peak, which doesn't put us that far off what markets were thinking when everybody was freaking out last autumn after the mini budget, when they were thinking 5.5 to 6% might be the peak. What does that mean for your personal finances? Well, A, it means that inflation might not go away as quickly as thought. B, mortgage rates, they might stop drifting down and get another bump up. In fact, we've already seen a bump up this week. Might be a blip. The good news is that banks and building societies are really quite keen to do business and lend to people, and they aren't quite freaking out like they were last autumn. So the competition there could keep rates down. Look back at Skipton Building Society releasing that 100% mortgage a couple of weeks back. It shows an appetite to lend from banks and building societies.
Right. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about mortgage rates edging up, but also hopefully savings rates going up as well in a wee while. But I do want to just dig in a little bit more to these inflation figures. Helen, I mean, it was based on what happened a year ago, and what happened a year ago was a huge spike in energy prices. So, of course, things are going to probably look a little bit better now than they did then, which was absolutely crazy. But is there anything good in these figures? I mean, what is high? What is going up? What is going down?
I mean, there's not that much good news. I think the thing that really hit me was food inflation is still really high. It's still 19%. And just some of the food items, like I think sugar has gone up by almost 50%. I think it's still really hitting people in the pocket on those core things like their mortgage, their food shopping. I mean, CPI inflation overall has gone down, which is on paper a good thing. Like you said, I'm sure the government will be cheering, but actually when you dig into the impact on people's day-to-day life, I think it's actually still pretty tough, unfortunately.
Petrol prices coming down though, diesel prices coming down?
Yeah, diesel down substantially. The bad news is that motorists are still being ripped off for diesel. If you listen to the AA and the RAC, petrol prices and diesel prices have come down. And that is an illustration of how things can get cheaper, but also an illustration of how petrol and diesel prices are volatile. They are one of those things where, you know, prices spike, you get a shock and so on. And they spiked so high that, yeah, they were at a considerably lower level now than they were, but they are, you know, quite a bit higher than they were not that long before. I mean, do you remember? I mean, obviously it was in lockdown and there was a reason for this. It nudged below £1 a litre.
I was about to say, Simon, it's another one of those examples where you're like, yay, I'm cheering something that's actually not that great. Because I do remember when it was talking about it just being below £1, and now we're what, 1.45 roughly?
But below £1 was exceptional. An exceptional scenario, especially when you consider the amount of tax that there is on it. I mean, ideally, you kind of want to be at like one. Well, ideally, they just give it to you free when you win. What I was going to say is, like, if you can't have £1, because that was like mid-lockdown, maybe £1.20, that'd be all right. You know, the problem is then you have the scenario where they worry about it encouraging people to drive and they start raising fuel duty. But what they really want to do, if they want to get people to stop driving, is make the trains cheaper and work better and actually have some buses that exist outside of London.
Right. So I'm curious now. So petrol price is 120, Simon. What do you reckon inflation is a good figure? The Bank of England say 2%. What do you think? Just give me some figures here, Simon. I'm going to play the game with me.
What would be my favourite inflation number?
Yeah, just pick a cool inflation number. What do you reckon?
Well, 2%.
I can ask you interest rates and everything.
2% is considered the golden number. Right. I think maybe you could. I think inflation targeting has a problem built into it, which is that by just having 2% target, the 2% target was the same in the early 2000s. The 2% target was the same after the financial crisis. The 2% target was the same in COVID. The 2% target is the same now. It doesn't take into account the world around it, and that actually there are times when it is harder to have inflation than other times when, you know, post-financial crisis, maybe the inflation target should have been lower. Perhaps it should have been 1%. But at times now, when you've clearly got global factors that are driving it up, perhaps the inflation target should be a bit higher. Perhaps it should be 3%. I think it should maybe, I don't think it should be stuck just at this golden 2%. Right. The problem is you then start moving it around to retrofit it to how you're doing.
So you're not playing the game though, are you, Simon?
It's just stuck at 2%. 3%. You
know. All right, there we go, 3%. 3%. Interest rates, what do you reckon is a good figure for that?
Oh, I mean, look, I think normal, old normal, like maybe like 4% is, ooh, you know, I'm sorry. Simon. It's, but I think that stops a lot of the mental asset price stuff. That's, look, if we'd have had interest rates at 4%, house prices wouldn't be anywhere near as high as they are now. People right. wouldn't be having to try to raise as much money to buy their first home or move home or all these other things. It would have been a much better scenario than the one where we had super, super low interest rates for so long.
Energy price cap, while we're on it.
I'd like to not have one. I'd like okay. it the energy market function properly so that we didn't have to have an energy price cap. I'd really good like answer. To go back to paying less than £1,000 a year for my bills.
I would also like to do that. Look, one question I want to ask you before I move on from this is inflation now really a worse threat than the, and we'll talk about rising mortgage rates in a minute, the negative impacts of high interest rates on people and businesses?
Once you start having inflation that sticks around for a long period of time, inflation starts compounding year after year, and it really starts eating into people's wealth and the spending power of their money. And we are celebrating a scenario, which we will talk about in a minute, where you can now get a 1-year fixed rate savings deal above 5%. The problem is you're still losing money in real terms. Now, if that's only for a short period of time, you know, you can handle it. But the longer that goes on, the worse it is, which is why they really, really, really want to crack down on inflation. The question is whether it, you know, this spike that's been driven by largely external factors is going to go away anyway. And then we will go back to a world of lower inflation that just sticks there, or whether we're going to go back to a scenario where I think there's a strong chance we will see where we move back to a period of inflation and rates rising and falling over relatively short cycles. And that's what we might need to get used to, rather than thinking we're going straight back to, you know, the decade before this, when it was just like inflation was permanently low and rates were permanently low and they just didn't move.
Thank you very much. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam Northerby Toro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Hi, Simon. Yeah, an interesting one as it draws to a close, and it sets us up quite nicely as we look to wrap up the month over the next week. US debt ceiling talks have really been the prominent factor for whether the market's gone higher or lower. Some days have been positive, some days negative. On the whole, it seems like we're inching closer to some sort of a deal, but of course there are likely to be bumps in the road. Also, now a rate hike in the US at their next meeting has gone to 50-50, which is a lot higher than what it was a week, 2 weeks ago. A lot of people in the market expected a pause. We've also had Nvidia earnings, which came out earlier this week. The market absolutely loved it. It was actually the third biggest gain in US stock market history. For the market cap there of an individual company at $184 billion. Nvidia is now responsible for a third of the S&P 500 gains this year, which is remarkable. From the UK, the week started okay. PMI data looked all right, albeit signalling the best was behind us. But the inflation number, despite finally coming below 10%, is still really high. The core number was a lot higher than expected. So it looks like the Bank of England haven't done too well here. Further rate hikes expected. And the FTSE actually has underperformed most equity markets in the last quarter as well.
So not the happiest of weeks, unless you were an Nvidia shareholder, at which point you would have been celebrating. Yes. What do we have to look forward to next week?
Well, the bank holiday, I think for some UK-related investors, that might be a good thing. But it actually still is a busy one. We've got the month end, which always brings a little bit of drama, as mentioned. We've also got the jobs report out of the US on Friday and updates on the US debt ceiling too. From Europe, we've got unemployment rates and inflation rates from the Eurozone as a whole, but also the separate companies, as well as some manufacturing data out of China, which will be pretty important as they continue their post-lockdown recovery, one to keep an eye on. UK-wise, from a scheduled point of view, it's pretty quiet. And along with that bank holiday, it's probably quite a good thing. So attention elsewhere from the UK might be the blessing we all need.
Well, I hope you have a good bank holiday weekend, and I hope everybody else does and celebrates the day of quiet.
Yes, absolutely, Simon.
Welcome back. Mortgage rates, as Simon mentioned earlier, look to be edging up. Nationwide hiked its fixed and tracker mortgage rates by up to 0.45% this week, as markets price in the base rate rising to 5.5%. Experts are saying that those with fixes ending soon should speak to a broker now. Helen, is it just nationwide? What have they done? How high are rates now anyway?
So I think the first thing is it's important to say this is more of a sort of edging up than the mad fast rate rises that we saw back in October last year after the mini budget. They went up a lot, then they kind of have been creeping down and down and down since about maybe December last year, the start of this year. But they're now edging up again a little bit. And I think this is because we're now predicting with these inflation figures, you know, analysts are looking at the base rate and they're saying that's probably going to go up. When the base rate goes up, mortgage rates go up. So I think banks are kind of getting ahead of that and pricing it in. So what's happened, Nationwide has put up some of their rates by up to 0.45%. It's always difficult to tell when banks put their mortgage rates up because strangely, they don't like to shout about it. They kind of do it quite quietly. But it looks like Nationwide aren't the only ones. We've seen some rises from Halifax and Santander. We've also seen some of the specialist mortgage lenders. So these are generally buy-to-let specialists. Some of them are Mortgage Works, Paragon, Kent Reliance. They withdrew some of their rates from the market yesterday, and they're probably going to reintroduce them at rates which are more expensive. So it does seem like there's a handful of lenders doing this, and obviously more could follow in the coming days, you know, where one starts, others tend to follow. So yeah, it is, it's a bit of a concern. Where we're at on the average mortgage rates now is 2-year fix, 5.34%, and 5-year fix, 5.01%. So that's a little bit higher than they've been in recent. They've been kind of edging down a little bit more around the kind of high 4, low 5%. So it's a little bit of an increase. I think people who maybe fixed in the last few weeks might start to feel, I'm not going to say lucky, because obviously compared to what mortgage rates were a year or so ago, they're not lucky at all. But it's starting to look like maybe people who fixed in the last few weeks got in at the right time in the current environment.
Just guesswork, isn't it? It's crazy. Simon, would this be the same Nationwide that we spoke about last week that's giving customers 100 quid? It seems like they're just taking it back again, no?
I mean, one of the qualifying things was to have a mortgage with them. So if you do have a mortgage with them and you're in the position of remortgaging, then you may find yourself in the unfortunate position where they have given with one hand and taken away more with the other. But, you know, they have to price according to the market. They can't just, you know, kind of price for the quirk in the system where somebody might be like right in the process of remortgaging. I had my letter from Nationwide.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Telling me I'm going to be getting my £100 between the 13th of June and the 30th of June. So right. If you think you qualify and you haven't had an email or a letter, then chase them up, ask them, where's my cash? Right. When am I getting my cash? So, you know,
Helen's
got her letter.
She's
got this through from Nationwide this morning on my desk, and I've just realised that's what it must be. It says on the envelope, something special we want to share with you. So
mortgage rates are going up. Not, but sorry. Yeah, you're getting 100. Am I the only one not with Nationwide here?
Look, they've got a lot of customers. They're the country's biggest building society. This is how this works. It also shows why it's worth, you know, keeping just a bit of cash in a savings account with your building society or bank, with your building society, in case they decide to do this. Banks almost.
I was going to say, on the off chance that your bank will give you 100 quid. Yeah, right.
But I know it's a gimmick, but I do think it's quite a good thing that they're giving people this money.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that, and interestingly, they're kind of indicating that they might do this every year.
So that'd be nice.
I know. You know, we talk about when are people going to reward loyal customers, but there are a lot of people who aren't getting anything,
right?
Who are a bit grumpy because they have been customers for a very long time, but they don't have, you know, the two qualifying things, the current account and the savings account, or the current account and the mortgage.
We digress, though. Apologies, I took you off on a path there that we weren't intended to go down. But Helen, those whose fixes are ending soon, you've been speaking to an expert for this particular article. What have they been telling you?
Sure. So this is actually my colleague, Fran Ivans. Don't want to take credit for her article, but she spoke to a broker at John Charcoal, Nicholas Mendez, and he said, anyone within 6 months of their fixed rate ending or plan to apply for a new mortgage should talk to a broker as soon as possible to secure a rate, or be prepared to sit it out for a few months in the expectation that rates start to fall this year or early next. So I thought that was quite interesting because, I mean, this is obviously only one broker's opinion. I'm sure some others would give different advice, but he's basically saying get in now or maybe wait for a while. If it looks like the direction is that rates are going up, either fix now or see where things go for a while, which might not be bad advice. The thing to mention is that you can usually, if you need to remortgage, you can lock in a rate 6 months in advance of your fix actually ending. So some will be maybe 3 months, but normally there will be some kind of yes, or advance period where you can lock in a rate and that's secured for when your fix does end. So it's something that's worth exploring and definitely worth chatting to a broker at the minute. And, you know, they'll be able to advise you on what deals are out there, what the best rate you could get is, you know, depending on the situation, whether you should remortgage now or sit tight.
Mm. So potentially not good for those with a mortgage, but better news for savers, a number of providers up their rates this week. How do you bag the best deals out there, Helen? What is out there?
We've had a real bump in savings rates this week, actually. Obviously, we always have this thing where, you know, bad for mortgage holders, good for savers. Obviously, a lot of people are both. But there's a number of Best Buy deals this week. So current Best Buy on Easy Access is from the savings and investment app Chip. So they've put up their rate from 3.71% to 3.82%. It's the best on the market. And that, you know, that's pretty decent compared to what we've seen. If you look back to a couple of years ago when rates were still less than 1%, that's clearly doesn't beat inflation, but it's a pretty decent return. So if you put £10,000 into that account, you'd earn £382 in interest in a year. So not to be sniffed at. Fixed rates have also improved this week. So Investec and Smart Save Bank have both launched some market leading deals. Investec is 5% and Smart Save is on 5.01%. So that's about £500 in interest over a year. And that's the same reason as mortgage rates going up. So banks kind of looked at the base rate probably going up and said, well, we can probably afford to pay a little bit more interest to savers.
So good news there. Helen, thank you very much. Simon, could we be on the verge of financial Armageddon across the world? Goodness. It's all to do with something called the US debt ceiling and the US maybe defaulting on its debts. Never a good thing. But why should it affect us here? What's going on, Simon?
Right. So people will have been hearing about this thing, but it's often one of those kind of slightly obscure things that passes people by. This crops up every so often, and in fact it cropped up a few years back, and basically the US has a debt ceiling. It's the government's pre-agreed limit on borrowing. Like many large major Western economies, the US government runs quite a lot of debt, and it has this limit on where it can go to. And if the debt ceiling isn't raised before the deadline, then in theory, the worst case scenario is a US debt default. We've got till the 1st of June. That sounds quite bad, doesn't it? Particularly when you consider that US government bonds are considered one of the world's safest financial assets. They are literally the cornerstone of safe financial asset investing, US Treasury bonds. So the idea where the US might default on that debt is one that strikes terror into people's hearts. So why are people not panicking an awful lot more, you may ask? Because it's the 26th of May today and the 1st of June is next week. It's because basically everybody assumes a deal will be struck, but not until the US is hovering right on the very brink of a debt default. So you're starting to see some nerves over this, but not panic. There's basically gridlock in Washington. The Democrats and the Republicans cannot agree on what should be done here. And in theory, once US borrowing hits the ceiling, its politicians either have to agree to raise it again or the country defaults on its debt. But Congress has already passed laws previously to spend the money that ran up to the debt above the limit. Raising the ceiling is basically a retrospective decision to settle its own bills. And it has done this before, grudgingly. So big fights before this, but it happened in 2011, it happened in 2013. And we saw scenarios where actually some kind of state departments shut down and weren't doing work. The problem is that this is a game of sort of, you know, a standoff between the Democrats and the Republicans. And it's just not a particularly sensible way of doing things, because whilst it may not default, and if it did default, it would like damage its credit rating. The credit agencies would have to downgrade its bonds and so on. You know, people would still, it wouldn't be that like everybody was holding these bonds and they were suddenly completely worthless. I mean, that's a very extreme scenario, but it undermines the financial system and it undermines the US. And the concern is the fact that, you know, this, you know, happening and this argument happening again and again is not just confined to the world of Washington politics and people shouting at each other across the room, that it is actually kind of undermining some of the faith in the US as a cornerstone of the financial system. It's not going to stop being a cornerstone of the financial system, but it's not particularly good.
No. I was wondering, like, what would happen? Would, like, you know, the bailiffs come around, Mexico come back, take Texas or something? I mean, what would be the sort of repercussions? But you sort of outlined it there. But okay, so it, you know, you lose faith in the US a little bit, then what?
Well, I mean, if it defaulted on its debt, then that would be a massive issue. You know, that's not going to happen kind of thing. Well, I mean, it might do, but everyone's in a kind of, this is not going to happen. You know, in the words of James Yardley at Fund Caliber, he said, a default on US bonds is unthinkable and would likely lead to financial Armageddon across the world, given the safest asset in the world is deemed to be US government bonds. Treasuries,
I mean, that's a big statement, isn't it? What does financial Armageddon look like? I mean, we had the financial crisis. That was pretty bad. Is it going to be
What you see first is a government shutdown, right? Where basically the departments shut down because they're not being funded anymore. So they can't continue doing the stuff they're meant to be doing because nothing's paying for them to be doing it. But another one of those is really quite damaging. It's like, firstly, you know, it's damaging to the economy because there are days lost when people aren't doing the things that they should have been doing, like strike days, for example. But secondly, it's seen as this kind of like daft brinkmanship that's going on. I mean, it does ask the question of whether this debt ceiling thing is not something that should be removed. But it's there for a reason. It's there to say, look, hey, we don't want to go above this. The thing is, you just keep going above it and keep going above it and keep going above it. So it is a bit of a pantomime.
Okay. So, you know, where there are troubles, there are opportunities, as we always say. So how can investors seize the opportunities or indeed just weather the storm?
Well, I mean, if you think, look, a deal's definitely going to be done and markets are going to bounce back, you might think, okay, markets have been driven down by this and they're at a cheaper level than they should be. So I'm going to buy in on the basis that they're going to bounce back. You might buy into a fund that's quite exposed to, like, you know, America's high growth companies like Baillie Gifford American, which has really, really suffered over the last year and a half due to the rising interest rates, collapse in tech stock and more speculative stock and growth stock valuations. You might go for one with more exposure to the domestic economy. These are mentioned by James Yardley in the article that Tanya wrote, Premier Miton US Opportunities, or an equity income, JPM US Equity Income. We might go for bonds, M&G's Global Macro Bond Fund, you know, because the bond prices will be really driven down by this. The bond market will be rocked by this, and all the Allianz strategic bond. But what you might want to think about is that everybody thinks this is going to get sorted. And so that's already in the price. So if you buy in now, you're not really buying anything cheaper because everybody's slightly worried about this, because everybody's slightly worried but thinks it's going to get fixed. So, you know, maybe it's if there's a really heavy market sell-off and everyone's saying this really heavy market sell-off is due to do this, like if it goes really to the wire, you might want to jump in. But you've got to, again, remember that everybody still is going to think that it's going to be fixed. So it's quite difficult. And also you're doing that thing called timing the markets, which doesn't always pay off. But buying stuff when it's cheap does. So I would say evaluate that investment based on what you think its long-term prospects are, not because you think in 3 days' time it's going to rebound because somebody stopped playing daft over in the US over the debt ceiling.
Right. Well explained, Simon. Thank you very much. Talking about something that's not very cheap at the moment, that is a VW camper van, should you want to purchase one. Camper van... inflation, camper van inflation, camper vanflation. I'm not sure. Tell me more about this.
Camper vans absolutely boomed over the pandemic. Staycations, the most badly named thing ever, because a staycation, you would actually stay in your home, and a staycation just consisted of going on holiday in Britain, but nobody could create a portmanteau for going on holiday in Britain, so they used staycation instead. Saw a boom in camper vans as people tried to take advantage of the periods of the year when they were not confined to their houses to go off and stay somewhere in the UK and explore the UK because they weren't allowed to leave the country. You are allowed to leave the country now with no restrictions. And apart from the restrictions placed on us by the difficulty of actually getting out of the country sometimes due to maybe not having enough border staff and stuff like that. But you would think now that camper van prices would be falling because A, you can go to Spain or France or Italy or America or all these other places. And B, loads of people bought these 2-3 years ago. And generally, there is a phenomenon where you see a spike in something and people go out and buy these things. In about 2 or 3 years' time, they realize that actually, I don't think I really wanted a camper van. It's actually a bit too much hassle. It's costing me quite a lot of money to run it. There's a cost of living crisis going on. I can't really afford this van that I'm not really using that much. And so they sell them. So you get more of them coming onto the market, which then drives down the prices. But no, instead, the opposite is happening. Camper van prices are continuing to rise, especially classic ones. VW Type 2 campers, that's your classic VW camper van, but then also the more modern ones, the more boxy 80s ones. And also we're still continuing to see a rise in the kind of California era ones, the more modern era ones, but the most in demand are the early camper vans. There's still a big classic car demand out there and people still like the camper vans.
Right. Helen, fancy a camper van?
Absolutely not. Not for me. I have
not that lifestyle.
No, my dad used to have one of those 80s camper vans when I was a teenager, and I have a really strong memory of sitting by the road somewhere between Birmingham and Cornwall for about 3 hours with like smoke coming out of the back of my dad's 80s camper van in the rain while we waited for someone like the AA to come and fix it. Honestly, one of the worst days of my life. It's not for me. And as a teenage girl being told that you have to go to the loo in a bucket, not for me. But you know, great for people who are into it.
yeah toilets and buckets, not for me either. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast paths and join in the debate and read your comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? Helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.